Hi, my name is Matt Brunig. I am a blogopreneur at Demos, The Week, and Salon, and my own website, mattbrunig.com. And I'm joined by Elizabeth Stoker.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Stoker. I am a writer at The Week and Salon, a few other venues, and I'm a student at Cambridge of Christian Ethics.
We had a piece this week in the New Republic about a child allowance. Do you want to explain what that is?
So I think that the child allowance piece had one of the best backstories of any of the pieces that we've ever co-authored because we were genuinely trying to think of something that would have bipartisan appeal, and that would have the effect of supporting children and their families. I know it was based in some data that you actually produced, original data that you had come up with about a week or so previous that had to do with single mothers. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, that it was actually based, it was based before that,
Well, right.
right, so just but that specific data. So that data, so I was trying to figure out, so the conservative line, one of the conservative lines is to say, well, the problem with poverty in this country is that we have too many single mothers.
Right.
And my position on that is always like, well, single mothering doesn't cause poverty. Having no money causes poverty, and single mothering does not, in and of itself, lead to not having money, right? I mean, there are physical constraints in the world, but at the end of the day, single mothering only causes poverty if distributive institutions accommodate that reality. And so I wanted to see what other countries were like with regards to their single mother population and family composition and stuff like that. So I did some searching and I read a number of studies and I found one that had some interesting data. I found a few that had interesting data, but one had it all kind of laid out the way I was looking for. And basically what you find is that our family composition has very little to do, has in fact nothing to do with the rates of child poverty in this country relative to others. The gap between our countries and others has nothing to do with family composition, and you can test this by sort of simulating as if we had the same family composition of others while holding all the poverty rates the same, and you can figure this out. And then I keyed in on single mothers in particular, and the lowest poverty countries in the world, the Nordic countries of Finland and Denmark and Norway. I guess I use Sweden, not Denmark. They had just as many single mothers as we did, but they had far lower poverty rates. All their single mother poverty rates for children, the child poverty rates, were less than 10, whereas ours is over 50. And the reason that's the case, you can look it in the data, is because they have transfer programs. They use things like child allowances and other things like that to make sure that people who find themselves in those positions are not that impoverished relative to the US at least.
So, in the process of thinking about this, just to kind of supplement the backstory, in thinking about a really truly bipartisan program, I know that one of the arguments that we kept running into came out of the right and came out of the Christian right specifically and had to do with the sort of role of government. I think that a lot of leftists are kind of quick to dismiss this argument because we have it a lot, and all of the rhetoric is pretty much overplayed. And the moment somebody brings up the role of government, you know that you're mostly at an impasse. I mean, you're just going to disagree and move on. But I kind of took it seriously in writing this piece. Not that it shouldn't be taken seriously in general, but rather that it isn't. And I took seriously specifically some of the arguments that we've heard out of Paul Ryan, having to do with subsidiarity, which is actually a piece of Catholic social teaching that comes out of a couple of old encyclicals, Rerum Novarum and then Quadriges Humano, and has been revisited many times since then. But as a piece of social teaching, the idea is that basically higher instantiations of society shouldn't completely subsume or arrogate lower instantiations. So If a community is capable of helping itself, a more powerful next level up, a state or a county, shouldn't come in and stomp all over them, even in the process of trying to help them, so long as they actually can take care of themselves. And Paul Ryan proposes subsidiarity as being one of the specifically Christian reasons that we shouldn't have, you know, basically means-tested welfare programs, because they do tend to have impacts on behavior, on what people will do with the resources that welfare programs give them. And I think that one that's frequently brought up is like food stamps. You can't buy certain things on it, and that is going to shape your behavior in one way or another. And then it, you know, you have lots of government being involved, and even the cereals a family is buying. And that's what the right, I think, comes at a bit in terms of government being overly involved or overly influential in family life. Which is why I think that there are a couple of good Christian ethical reasons that the government should set up a child allowance. One of them being
Would you mind explaining, because we didn't actually say what it was yet, what a child allowance is.
Oh, okay, yes, a child allowance, right. Just to lay out the piece quite basically, it would be not means-tested, and it would be a stipend, basically, that was rendered monthly to families based on the number of children they had. And I know that you had written that you can do different calculations with amounts. In the piece, we proposed $300 a month.
Mm-hmm. $300 per month, right. per child. Just to do some calculations on its impact.
Right. And when you ran that data, they actually had, it had a really major impact on both child and adult poverty, which would be an amazing boost for families.
Right. Child poverty was reduced 42%. It didn't have that much reduction on overall adult poverty, just because there's so many adults that don't, you know, they're older or whatever, they don't have kids. But quite a few of them, I mean, the parents of the children who were brought out of poverty are brought out of poverty as well, because that's the way poverty works, right? So, but anyway, so with that explained, to continue with your line of thought on subsidiarity.
Well, just to return to the reasons that it is truly a bipartisan solution is, unlike some of the welfare programs that people on the Christian right do criticize for being unduly influential in family life, a child allowance would really truly be a stipend. I mean, it wouldn't be the government coming in and saying you had a special card with which you could buy school supplies and some food. It would be whatever your specific needs as a family were, you would have that cushion. Which, I mean, I think is a really extraordinary thing, and it goes a lot towards the government acting as an exemplary force, which is a secondary Christian ethical reason I think the child allowance is a good idea. But before I get into unsubmerging the government as an exemplar, you had talked about the dependability of the child allowance being a special feature as a program.
Yeah, so for my part, I wasn't focused as much, you know, we had different focuses on sort of the advantages of it, and I was focused on two specific advantages. One of them was dependability, and dependability is a very simple kind of idea. Every month, you know, just like Social Security, if you're retired, you know you're going to get a certain amount each month. You can budget it, you can put it into, you know, you can know, oh, I can put it towards my kid, I can get this housing, I can, you know, it's... As opposed to in the status quo, we do have systems that are sort of aimed at helping parents by providing them financial assistance through the child tax credit and the personal exemption. But these come once a year in an annual lump sum. I don't think most people budgeted them in or are capable of budgeting them in, because it's very complicated to even know how much the child allowance is worth. Because of the way how much the child tax credit is worth,
right.
Because it's built into the tax code. It's very complicated. And there's this thing called the additional child tax credit. I don't think most people are actually capable of sort of budgeting that in. And so they get this windfall, and that's not really helpful if you're thinking about providing assistance to kids. You know, you want them to have a dependable budget and boost that budget significantly, not just have a once a year windfall that is, you know, you do whatever you do with it, I guess.
Right.
That was the dependability argument.
Which also, I mean, so I guess I'm kind of operating here as the voice of the skeptical right-wing Christian who's trying to negotiate my way into agreement with this policy. So I know that some of the critics that we encountered proposed that maybe you should just boost the child tax credit or something along those lines, or they argued that this would be just as complicated as a bureaucratic structure. But when we look at other countries, do we see this kind of this level of complication or?
No, it's not remotely as complicated. And I mean, and that brings me into the second issue with the problem with boosting the child tax credit as it's been proposed is that the child tax credit, this is a little bit technical, but it's a non-refundable credit, which means that you only get it up to the amount of your tax liability. So if suppose you're a family and you make $10,000 a year, right? And your tax liability, after personal exemptions and stuff like that, let's say you're a couple and you don't have a kid. So after personal exemptions, your tax liability is almost nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have a kid. Well, so how much is the child tax credit worth to you? Well, it's worth almost nothing because it doesn't actually, it only gives you assistance up to the level of your tax liability. So you're 10,000, you make 10,000, you have a kid, you get no real help. But if you're making 50,000, you get a lot of help, right? So if you increase the child tax credit to 3,500 or something like that, you can get to the point where the benefits to middle, upper middle, and upper class parents is $3,500 per kid, whereas the benefits for poor parents can be zero to maybe, you know, 500, about, you know, whatever. It'll go up a scale as you make more money, which is makes no sense, you know. If the idea is to provide social assistance to kids, when you have a kid, you should get the same amount of assistance, or we might say more assistance if you're poor, but at minimum, not more assistance if you have more income. Like that's their proposal. And that's a very, and the way the child tax credit is set up right now is very, very complicated. Like I told you before, there's this other thing called the additional child tax credit. There's a phase out period after a certain income level. I think it's 60,000, but it might be higher now. It's really complicated to actually know how much you're going to get, though. You just use software and, you know, to figure that out at the end of the year. Whereas a child allowance is actually quite simple. It's used in Sweden. It's used in France. It's used, some things like it are used elsewhere. And implementing it is pretty easy because we already have an agency that sends out checks to people every month called the Social Security Administration. It sends out a lot of them, not just to old people, also to people on disability insurance. And you know, what do you do when you have a kid? Your kid gets a Social Security number. Like you're already registering with the thing. You know, there's some logic, there's some logistics involved in, you know, getting addresses and setting up direct deposits and stuff like that. But it's definitely a doable thing. We know because we already do it for tens of millions of people every month. So.
Right. And because it would be equally distributed all the way up and down the income ladder, it really is more like a public good in terms of, you know, state features that it resembles than the welfare programs that are means tested that we're used to. So in terms of being in line with an approach that is sort of informed by subsidiarity, I think because it functions that way, it's much more amenable to the type of reasoning that we've seen come out of people like Paul Ryan. So ideally, it seems like a policy we could really have a shot at. And another good thing it does is poverty has a way of shaping the decisions you make about your family size. So, for instance, one of the other pieces that I wrote during the period that we were working on this had to do with being pro-life on the left, which was met with a lot of institutional left resistance. And I know that's not a very popular position that I hold, being someone who's a leftist politically in most ways. But I was able to track down a survey, it's actually quite recent, it's from 2013, that outlined a lot of the reason that women chose to have abortions. The survey was actually pretty well designed, I think, in that it asked open-ended questions. It didn't give people a checklist and say, why are you doing this? And then kind of lock them into reasons that the researchers had decided were important. It asked open-endedly and let people fill out in their own words why they were seeking abortions. And then the researchers organized those into 11 broad themes. And the lion's share, the biggest chunk, 40% said they just weren't financially prepared, that they just didn't have the money. And then a lot of other reasons that were phrased differently seemed to play off that, such as, I need to support my other children. That 29% said that, that there were other issues having to do with housing. That was a pretty good chunk, or paying for things that were related to the baby, like getting a larger place, or just the more general, I want a better life for my baby, which seems like it could be impacted by having the financial security to start making motions towards building up a more secure living situation. So all of those were overlapping, but again, it appeared to me that knowing that your child was going to come with a financial cushion that you could rely on, that wasn't coming from a crisis pregnancy center that had a limit. So, I mean, we think that the child allowance should be distributed until 18. Right, roughly. I mean, that seems.
Yeah, sometimes, you know. 16 people mm-hmm. do 16. Sometimes, you know, whichever.
But certainly not going to end in the toddler years or the preschool years or anything like that.
Although,
right.
Although sometimes there, I've seen proposals that set up to where you get more mm-hmm. for the first 5 years, and then you get a little bit right. less later. So that, you know, kind of accounts for extra need for that first few years. You know.
Well, and for mothers who work and are looking at having to have children, that
right.
daycare being mm-hmm. an extra exactly. need. But however it's set up, you would at least know that your baby is coming to you with a parachute rather than an anchor. So it's actually going to have some sort of financial cushion, which I think is an amazing thing. I mean, and I think that people on the right who are pro-life and people who are on the left who are pro-life, they're, you know, certainly a smaller proportion, but even people who are pro-choice but interested in seeing some programs that could maybe allow women to not be economically coerced into abortion would be really, really happy about this program. And I think one of the most exciting things about it.
I don't think anyone who's pro-choice wants people to be forced to make that decision for economic reasons that are avoidable.
No, but one of the things that I found just about having this argument is that the people who are most ardently pro-choice, I mean, a few names come to mind, they're not very amenable to talking about reasons that women have abortion. And I agree that women have abortions for usually overlapping and stacked reasons that are very complicated and very personal. But the fact of the matter is that there is usually some push factor that's not very pleasant that you would want to remove. But the reason that gets brought up most often is just not wanting a kid, which doesn't actually appear, according to the surveys anyway, to be why women have abortions. It appears to be living situation, resource issues in large part. There are other things that are not related, that are truly unrelated, such as having a partner problem, partners who are abusive, and so on and so forth. But a huge chunk of the otherwise pretty fractured reasons have to do with income. And in my mind, the women who list those factors as major are being coerced into it in the same way that people who take high risk or extremely low income jobs, because there literally is no other choice, should have some protection in form of wage laws and other forms of workplace safety laws. Because just because you can't make another choice doesn't mean the choice that's available to you should be destructive to your person, right? Because it's a coerced choice at that point. So that's sort of the reasoning I was applying there, to go on a bit of a tangent. But again, not super well received by most people on the left. But
Is it really? I mean, because that's 100% in line with sort of reproductive justice framework
right.
ideas well, about it, right? Sort of with the reproductive justice framework having this like capability approach to mm-hmm. essentially families and reproduction, right? So it's like you should have the capability to select what you want to select, and if society doesn't provide doesn't distribute income in a way that allows you to have the family you want and when you want and that kind of thing, then that's a harm within that sort of left wing repro justice framework. So I don't know. I mean, maybe there's like a framing. It's a frame.
Well,
thing
right.
Or
that's what it is. It's that. I think on the pro-choice leftist side, what you're going to hear is, you know, we want the choice to be completely neutral. That is, women who have abortions should be having them for no other reason than I just don't like babies, or I just don't want a kid. I don't want to have a kid or anything like that. I think on the leftist pro-life side, you know, we just don't want women having abortions at all. So there's going to be a lot of different directions that you're going to come at, because there are a lot of different reasons people have abortions. And one of them is going to have to do with making it as possible as it can be to have a family. And that has to do with resources. But because the pro-life position implies other approaches as well, rather than just making it a completely neutral plane, I think that's what gets me into some trouble. But this policy itself would be amenable to either side as it is. It's a framing issue.
But the other impacts as well are going to be, you know, no one wants women to be poor, women with children to be poor.
No, yeah, absolutely not.
Poor
right.
on the left, you know, right. like so.
No, this, we're just talking fringe benefits at this point. It's just a potential benefit we could see. And I'm upfront about my reasoning, because I think it's you know, reasonable to produce a coherent position. But we were also going to talk about the exemplary role of the child allowance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was one of your arguments, or that you were more leading on this mm-hmm. topic. So what do you think? What's your argument on that front?
I think that, you know, there's a long Christian history of, and I mean in terms of Christian history, we can see lots of Christian writers sort of proposing this idea over the years that because the state is such a visible and such a symbolic force, and that it symbolizes power and order and so on and so forth, when the government chooses to promote behaviors that are extraordinarily bad, that is, you know, morally harmful to its people. And when the government chooses to promote behaviors or practices that are good, that's helpful to its people. That can be government serving a very salutary purpose. I think that the government committing in a very concrete and visible way to supporting family life is an amazing thing. I think that is a fantastic move in terms of talking about the role of government. And I think it could be just a wonderful sort of overlay to the sort of social texture, knowing that our government is really firmly and concretely committed to family, and not in just like a think of the children way, but actually in a really dedicated and concerted way, the government putting its money where its mouth is and saying, okay, we're really going to support you having
right.
children and being families.
And your argument, or maybe this was my addendum to it, was that this even operates relative to like child tax credit and stuff like
right.
that, because
mm-hmm.
you know, there's this concept out there Suzanne Mettler came up with called the submerged state, mm-hmm. in which she talks about things like child tax credit and stuff
right.
like that. And you know, basically it's the way in which our spending is like wildly obscured. We spend tons of money on like mortgage interest deductions and tons of money on healthcare benefits, like the government subsidizes all employer health insurance, but most people are unaware of it. And one of the things she did she wrote a book on it, was she actually, there were surveys in it in which they would ask people, you know, have you benefited from this or that? And I don't remember specifically with the child tax credit, but the basic rundown was most people said that they hadn't benefited from all of the things that were kind of submerged, including the child tax credit. And so that's not a very exemplary
right,
way
yeah,
to
right.
say we as a society support families and children and paying for them, when nobody has any idea that,
right.
that they're receiving that those benefits. Whereas check in the mail, that's sort of everyone knows right. about, that kind of thing.
And we can see all around us that already we kind of tacitly operate on this idea that the government is an exemplar and that it's spending, and where it chooses to put its resources has an exemplary effect. You can see this in a lot of veteran rhetoric that, you know, they fought for our country should support them and honor them, and that has to do with benefits programs for veterans and so on and so forth. You even saw it during the Affordable Care Act debates. Mike Huckabee made a comment yeah. along the lines of, you know, when the government says it's going to pay for contraception, it is setting an example. It is informing women of something about themselves and saying that they can't control themselves or I don't remember how he put it, but his notion was that...
He called him Uncle Sugar.
Oh, yes. Right. Mm-hmm. Uncle Sugar. Right. That the government acting in that capacity was going to have a harmful moral effect because it
yeah.
was...
sets norms and stuff. Right. And women are going right. to want to be promiscuous or something like that.
Right. That it was kind of performing this, this moral norm.
Overboard in that case, but...
But it's definitely along those lines of logic. And right, the government right. was willing to say, well, okay, I'm going to be, I guess, Uncle Sugar for children and family. That's at least a positive Uncle Sugaring.
Yeah. Of this and I mean, that's what you get from some of the people who are proposing, like, the expanded child tax credit and stuff on the right. They have a similar, they couch it a lot in electoral language, like, you know, we'll get all the families to vote for us votes. And stuff like that, right? Yeah. But, like, the notion is that people will be aware of this and we will, that will be the, our party. Right. You know, of course, but of course the problem is that they're not really talking about family votes because the money is only going to middle and upper class families, which of course is tend to be the families that will vote Republican. So it's, you know,
but
it's more of a branding thing.
There are very good faith conservative arguments towards something like this. I think Ross did that in the New York Times, made an argument along these lines, and then there have been more recent instances, Rehan Salam and so on and so forth. People who I think are making them in good faith and not just electorally. So,
Well, those are the people I have in mind. I mean, mm-hmm. but they're proposing the child tax, just expanding the child tax credit.
Well, right,
not expand money to anyone who currently has no real tax liability.
But in terms of arguing sort of an exemplary child supporting. Mm-hmm. thing coming from the government, we have seen, I think, good faith right arguments in the form of tax credits, but of course for the reasons that you enumerated, this is better.
Much better, yeah. Well,
so there was a piece
that's
written
a good
recently.
Idea then.
Yeah, absolutely,
we should do that. I think everyone should get on board with that, and so we'll move on. So Meghan McArdle wrote a response to Piketty. She's of Bloomberg View and the book The Upside of Down, about failing, I think. Conservative. It wasn't really a response to Piketty because she says that she hadn't read the book, but she was making an argument about money can't mm-hmm. fix all the things. So do you wanna go through what her point was on that?
Well, it's a very interesting piece. It's I guess it's a non-book review in that she begins by saying she's not persuaded by Piketty and she hasn't read him, which is usually true.
I don't think she said she's not persuaded, did she? Maybe she did.
Well, she's not persuaded by the overall thesis, which would be that this would be an ameliatory way
to basically
go.
She knows the book is about inequality and here are some thoughts she has about reducing that.
Well, right. Yeah, not some thought she has about reducing inequality, but she basically presumes that the thesis of the book is that inequality is basically the biggest problem facing everyone. Mm-hmm. And she says, well, that's not true at all. And she alludes to having a top 20 real problems list. She doesn't give us those. She gives us the top 5 real problems. None of them are inequality. One of them is unemployment or mm-hmm. short-term or part-time employment being rampant. Finding a partner with a good employment situation is number 2. Falling in love and staying in love is number 3, and that's true. Having children who are economically secure is number 4, which we might have just come up with the answer to that. And then just having friends and, you know, just generally being satisfied in life is number five. And Piketty, she says, is not going to make you satisfied in life. He's not going to be your partner, and he's not going to make you happy in the long term. But some of those sound like they actually do have to do with inequality, which was a little bit confusing. So you've had a lot to say about Piketty, and I wonder what your response is. I mean, it's a very challenging argument. What is Piketty going to do to give me friends?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, if you have more money, I guess you
I could buy them.
Yeah, people like you can go hang. You know, actually, there was a report I blogged about it a long time ago. In the 60s or 70s, the government put together this report about poverty, and there was this long list of sort of things like this, and they were like, you know, how are you going to take it's part of the language is real old fashioned, right? So you have to take that for what it is, but they're like, how can you take a girl to the movies? And stuff like all these, how can you afford to go to the church? How can you buy a pop with your friends after school? And they had this whole list of things. It was very kind of touching, but there is in line with those kinds of complaints. It was like more along the lines of how can you have inclusion in a community, in a society and relationships if you don't have the money that's necessary to really build those things, not because you're buying them, but because that's what you need to like go out and be involved in society. You need to be able to, you know, drive places and have clothes and be able to go out to eat and stuff like that, right?
Well, right. And leisure time as well. I mean, leisure time is one of the biggest focuses of other states that do have more developed welfare regimes. And it usually those come along with in European social democracies, sort of state provided or leisure time, right? Vacation and so on and so forth.
Museum passes, remember that?
Right, yes.
When we were in Germany.
I do remember that.
If you were on some kind of benefit system, mm-hmm. you could go for free for their, like, museums. Free culture right. for poor people, basically, was the idea.
Right, and that does seem to answer at least one of her claims, but I think the broader and more overarching claim is that Piketty proposes a solution that actually wouldn't end all human misery.
Mm-hmm.
So you've read Piketty. Would he end all human misery? And is that something he claims to be prepared to do?
Well, you know what's interesting about Piketty is she didn't read the book, right? So that's a problem right there. But he's not really focused on sort of the poor. I don't know that he ever really mentions poverty or anything like that. He's really focused on sort of just runaway power and wealth and income at the top and the way in which that confronts like democratic and meritocratic ideals in society and the way that that can be inherited. I think he does care about the poor and that sort of thing, but that's really not what he's about. It's a very kind of sort of old school treatment of like the economy of like who owns everything and who, you know, that kind of thing. So he's even all of his prior work as well is he sort of blocks out the bottom 90%. He's like, he'll go through like 100 different brackets of the top 10%. It'd be like the top 10%, the 10 percentile to the 5 percentile, the 5 percentile to the 2 percentile. Like he's got this full thing and then he's just like, and the bottom 90. Like he's really not concerned about that. And so it's an interesting, you know, it's just totally irrelevant to what he's talking about, his project. But to sort of get on point here, if we imagine someone is saying, like we are, that, hey, you should just reduce inequality outright, and that that'll be good, the fact that, and this is what I wrote about on my blog, the fact that there's still going to be other problems, that people are still going to have other kinds of misery and pain from being alone or not having friends or something like that is just orthogonal to the question of, well,
right.
Well, shouldn't they at least there not be materially deprived? Like, isn't it better to have no friends and not be like hungry on the street than to have no friends and be hungry on the street, right? Like, it's always better to at least have material security, right?
It is. Right. I mean, well, it's just it's a very strange response in general to lead with. I don't know what is even in this book. However, I know that it's not the answer to all human misery. Sounds like she's going to pitch the Bible. I mean,
yeah, that's a sort of spiritual component to it.
Yeah.
And it's strange because you don't really know what her agenda is, because in and of itself, there's nothing inconsistent with that argument and saying, but we should still make sure everyone is provided for.
Right.
Almost no one's in poverty, or no one's in poverty. And or you could say both of those things simultaneously.
Right.
Well, I think she overstates the way in which these things interact, but or understates them. But so you don't leave knowing whether, I mean, I think her agenda is actually to say, hey, you know, don't worry about the fact that a lot of, you know, 1 in 5 children are in
right.
poverty in this country because, you know,
even if they weren't,
because, yeah, they're still going to have other problems, even if they, you know, are not food insecure and not hungry and that kind of thing.
Right. And I mean, this is actually a Christian ethical argument that gets made a lot about welfare programs, is that the only thing the state can provide to you are penultimate goods.
Mm-hmm.
The state can provide some material security. The state can provide law and order. The state can provide public goods, but it can't provide the ultimate goods to you, which have to do with the apprehension of the worship of God and so on and so forth, which you could easily extend her argument out and turn it into that. In that case, all right-wing political solutions also fail.
Yeah.
To provide the final thing. I mean, because the final thing
yeah.
is it has to be apprehended in some other way.
I feel like there's almost a role of government argument that you can make here. And of course, she's operating off of these like weird laissez-faire assumptions. But like in and of itself, the government can distribute resources. It does every day distribute resources through its institutions and laws, all of the resources. In fact, and so the question of whether or not it's competent, it's clearly competent in that regard, right? That is a role it has to undertake. But I think you could make a sort of limited government argument to say, but it can't solve existential ennui and other things like that. And that's a given. And that's exactly where communitarian institutions and stuff would presumably like be capable of coming
right
in
and other mediating institutions and society, voluntary associations and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. I do think it's a problem that there are lonely people. I also think that poverty factors heavily into isolation, and there's been a lot of sociological work on this by I think Eric Kleinenberg and some other authors. But that's to take her point a little bit more seriously, I'm sure, than she even intended it to be taken. The fact of the matter is that I'm sure she responded because Piketty is such a thing right now that some response was needed. So why don't you talk about the work that you've done on Piketty? Specifically, I know that you had an idea relating to a sovereign wealth fund.
Yes. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about a couple of things here.
Mm-hmm.
So in some of the reactions to Piketty, you know, there are economists that are dealing with him, and Piketty gives kind of a short, he's critical of economists in the book, and they seem to be doing a lot of the things that he's critical of in some of their reactions, like trying to operationalize and model what he's talking about. And one of the areas in which there seems to be a lot of confusion is on, well, what is he talking about with regards to capital?
Mm-hmm.
And when I read the book, I was totally clear on what he was talking about with regards to capital. But now, but then when I started to read the reviews, I realized, oh, these economists are trying to apply sort of like physicalist notions of capital. They're like, oh, is he talking about machines and buildings? And
mm-hmm.
if we add enough machines and buildings, won't the rate of return fall? And so on and so forth, right? So they have this sort of productive notion
right.
of capital, very like basic economist notion of it, whereas Piketty is not. That is not what Piketty is about. He defines capital throughout the book as essentially anything that your institutions have set up that you can own and trade that also generate some kind of financial return. And
why don't you give some examples here of how that deviates from the traditional understanding of capital? So rather than machines and buildings, it also includes.
Yeah, so you think of a machine and, you know, oh, so other things. So patents, mm-hmm. right? You own a patent, and what do you do with a patent? Well, most patents are just held in firms and stuff like that, and its shareholders disown the equity of the firm. But if you just held a patent outright, that would also be wealth, and you can license the patent to people. And a license is just like a rent, just like a return on the patent. And the patent will show up on your, you know, balance sheet as wealth that you own. That's not really physical capital, and licensing it out is not productive in any meaningful way. So there's stuff like that. There's copyright. There's, in the past, there were people were capital, right?
Right.
Anything of that sort that you can kind of buy and sell, various like financial instruments. Being on the other end of a debt arrangement, that's not always really capital. For instance, if you're on the other side of like a consumer credit situation, like you're on the creditor side, mm-hmm. that's not capital. Have you extended capital if someone's borrowed money from you to buy a loaf of bread or something? Right? Like, so all these things kind of get confused when people are trying to react that way. And so I wrote a piece in which I said, look, you know, he is taking capital in the more sociological, social constructivist sense. Capital is a thing we make with our institutions. It's something we invent. It's essentially power relationships with regards to things. And those power relationships can be very different across societies, across times. And they're totally dependent upon our laws and institutions. And so when people are like, well, won't the rate of return fall? Well, it depends. What will the institutions do? Will our governing and economic institutions accommodate a fall in the rate of return on capital assets? I don't know. Right? So for me, I look at Piketty just saying, look, I've observed that over time, the rate of return on capital has been essentially the same. Capital, as it's defined, just sort of broadly in this sort right. of social constructivist sense. And so when you come in and you're like, well, if we add more machines, won't that cause the rate of return to new machines to fall? It's like you've missed the point entirely. And so now we're seeing people try to operationalize that with statistics, with models and stuff like that, and it's really quite amusing to watch from my perspective and my interpretation mm-hmm. of Piketty. So I guess that was, and I wrote a post about this at Demos, and one of the interesting things is wealth understood in this sort of social constructivist sense, actually there's actually data that you can look at and mm-hmm. show that it's true in some sense. And there was a fellow named J.W. Mason who wrote a piece about this, and Piketty talks about it sort of in the book for a little bit. But in Germany, for instance, Germany shows up as having much less wealth than other countries in Europe, but it definitely doesn't have right. like much less buildings and stuff like that.
Right, right.
And the reason why it shows up that way is because they have all of these like restrictions. The way that they've constructed their power relationships with regards to things like corporate stock and ownership of rental buildings and stuff like that is so different from other places. So, for instance, corporations in Germany, like I think as much as a third of the corporate board is composed not of representatives of shareholders like they are in the country, but of workers from the firm. And so this ends up meaning that workers have a lot of power and control, or at least more power and control over what their corporations do than workers in the US. But then that also therefore means that owning that stock as a shareholder is less valuable.
Right.
And so that you end up show the asset value of that stock ends up being much lower than it would be. But that's not because the firm has much less right. capital on hand. That's not because the firm has less buildings and machines and stuff like that. It's just a function of how you've sort of constructed power relationships and how that ends up affecting asset prices. So, I think, you know, that's a kind of interesting it's an interesting thing to popped out of it, and it's interesting that a lot of the economist sorts have seemed to have totally missed it. But yeah, that was my wealth take. I guess so. The other thing was sovereign wealth fund.
What is a sovereign wealth fund for the uninitiated? I hear they can have major impacts on sort of global economy when countries decide to wield them. So, what's a sovereign wealth fund?
So, sovereign wealth fund is like so think about universities, right? So universities have endowments,
right,
which are these big piles of money, and they invest them, and then those endowments generate returns. And then we have foundations in this country, and the foundations also have these big piles of money that they invest in stocks and so on, and they get a return. A sovereign wealth fund is just like this, except it's owned and controlled by the government. So Alaska has one, for instance, just a big pile of cash. They've got it invested in, I'm not sure, you know, stocks and bonds and other investment vehicles.
Norway has a pretty reasonably sized one.
Yeah, I think Norway's might be the biggest, although I don't know, China's might be larger. Norway's is certainly the biggest per capita. Mm-hmm. And they've recently moved towards like divesting in oil and stuff like that, and that's caused some stirs. But so in the context of Piketty, I was proposing a sovereign wealth fund as a way to help solve some of these issues, right? So what Piketty is worried about is that capital ends up being held in the hands of a very small number of people. Right. So right after his book came out, there was a study from Gabriel Zucman and Emmanuel Sayers that had a really interesting rundown of wealth in the U.S. And they said 75% of the wealth is held by the top 10% of people. And Piketty says this probably is going to get worse over time. And the real trouble with this, or one of the real troubles with this, is that income flows to you if you have capital. And so that drives inequality then. If passive income, sometimes as much as a third of the income in a given year is flowing to people who own capital, 75% of which is held by the top 10% of people. Right. And so the way the sovereign wealth fund is meant to sort of blow this up is, well, just have the state own a whole bunch of the capital. Don't have it direct it in the sense, you know, of like a state run economy, but just have it own the stocks and bonds. Anyone can own stocks and bonds. Mm-hmm. You know, we have endowments and foundations all over the country that do this kind of thing. And so then the idea is, well, if we can get a lot of the capital in the hands of this sovereign wealth fund, then the returns on capital will flow to the government. And this is what Alaska does. And what Alaska does each year is it takes all the returns that it gets and it hands it out as a dividend to its citizens. So essentially it's holding all Alaskans' capital, not all of it, but all Alaskans have this big pot of capital that Alaska invests, and then Alaska gives them the returns each year.
So every year, Sarah Palin sends you a check in the mail.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. I never heard her advocate anything like that.
Well, it was put in place by a Republican governor, and there are other sovereign wealth funds in the U.S. There's six others, and they're all in GOP-run states. There's two in Texas, I think. Mm-hmm. It's this weird, like, it's one of those weird things that you end up getting conservative support. And I mean, it just makes a lot of sense, because if you have a sovereign wealth fund, you get money and you don't have to tax anyone for it. Right. Cause it's just flowing in passively. Right. But it's a form of market socialism that it was first come up with by market socialists as an idea, but conservatives get behind it. And in Alaska, one of the things they say is, we do this to keep the money out of the hands of the government. It's like in some sense you sort of see the logic there. They're like, well, we get all this money from the oil royalties and we don't want the government spending it. You could just give it straight out to people or don't charge the royalties. I mean, there's other ways to do it, but you know, we'll hold it in a big pot and pay out people year to year. It's kind of a weird argument that they have as to why it's conservative, but...
But a good outcome. I mean, it works for me.
Yeah, that's what they like to do. But that's the... So that's the idea, is to say, well, we could do this nationally. A lot of other countries, there's something like 47 of these things in the world, and build out a big fund, or a lot of smaller funds, if you want, and then we could pay out a dividend each year to everyone, and that would kind of socialize capital, but not in a way that is... disruptive
right.
to anything else, because no one, it doesn't matter who's sort of privately and secretly owning stocks, right? Companies don't even know necessarily who own their stocks at any given time. Sometimes they do if there's like shareholder stuff, but for the most part, they don't know on a day-to-day who owns any of their stocks. So it's totally doable to have that set up.
So in places where there are strong sovereign wealth funds, I wonder if you've looked at any data of having to do with before and after. I mean, do these appear to be sort of returning to the conversation we were having earlier about impacts in people's lives? Do these appear to have, you know, major impacts in the lives of the citizenry? And in terms of Alaska, for example, have you been able to get a hold of data that shows you the impact it has there?
You know, I've tried so hard to find the Alaska data. I went through the current population survey. I went through the American Community Survey, and I think the American Community Survey has the best shot at it. Anyways, the long story is there's not clear data like isolating this in any of the surveys that they do of Alaskan people, but we do know broadly that Alaska has, I believe last time I checked, it was the second lowest poverty rate in the country and also some of the least inequality in the country. And I don't think that is solely to do with the right. Sovereign Wealth Fund, but I mean, if you're sending out to every family, some of the years get as high as $3,000 for every person in your family. Family of four, that's 12 grand.
Wow.
You know,
yeah, most years
it's lower than that. It's like $1,000 or something like that, because it depends, you know, how well. You know, that's quite a bit of money. And you know, it's helpful. I don't know what Norway does with its money. I don't think it pays out dividends or anything like that, but in the future it might. I think that's a long run idea. Because the way that they fill out their sovereign wealth fund is they have a state owned oil company. the whole thing's very socialist. It's like, you know, we create this big state-owned oil company because why should we give our oil to a private company? And then we'll take all the profits from it. We'll build out this giant fund that we'll all own collectively. Doesn't that sound nice?
So what are the major critiques? I can only begin to imagine, but I know that you have had resistance to your sovereign wealth fund idea, having written about it at Demos and on your blog. So what are the major criticisms? Are they the ones we would expect, or?
One criticism was, so far I just want to repeat like how this works as far as like avoiding inequality. So we take a lot of the capital that's held in the private sector, and we do this over time, and we hold it publicly. So that, you see, like, reduces.
Right.
So I just want to make that clear. So the objections. Well, so the first objection is, hey, if we have a giant sovereign wealth fund, then when the government decides how to invest, that's going to move markets, right? Because, I mean, imagine you have this giant actor. And the way you deal with that is you say, okay, well, we're not going to have literally like one fund. We can have 40 funds, and they'll all trade privately from one another, right? They don't work with one another. And there you go. Now they're trading against each other. They're trading against other people, and you still keep, you still keep that sort of capital market running. That would be how you deal with that. Some people say, well, how are you, you know, sort of related to that? They say, well, how are they going to vote their shares? Because shareholders vote sometimes.
Right.
They're like, if they voted their shares, they would be such a big block. But the reality is that we have much bigger blocks than them already, because blocks are voted in line with the there are these companies, these shareholder proxy companies, called some of them like ISS and Glass Lewis, that already vote giant blocks of shares. And so I don't, you know, the U.S. would not even be as big as they are if it had a giant sovereign wealth fund, right? So I don't know how, like, that's not really a serious objection.
Right.
Beyond that, you know, there's just a sort of, oh, there's, you know, cronyism and this and that sort of stuff, you know. But, you know, I mean, that's possible sort of in any fund, right?
Right, like, right.
You could corrupt the Harvard endowment people, I'm sure, right? Take them out to a baseball game. And, yeah, you know, I mean, you can do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, universities anyway, already have to deal with that, so.
Right, that's just like a basic agency issue. You have an agent, how are you going to control them? You would just use the same rules. I mean, in my mind, they have a fiduciary duty. If they violate it, you know, you huge liabilities for them personally. If they you know, go against it, go against the line and stuff like that, and just, you know, keep it somewhat insulated as best you can from that sort of politics.
There was one other point, switching gears from the sovereign wealth fund, that I had meant to bring up in the discussion of Piketty that had to do with social determinants of unhappiness related to welfare programs. So periodically you'll hear the argument posed that, and I think Paul Ryan is a proponent of this, and it's not uncommon among Christian right, that, well, welfare programs ultimately aren't a solution to poverty because they don't give people satisfaction. So I think Paul Ryan used the phrase full stomachs and an empty soul, that government welfare programs can provide only a very little, and that falls under the penultimate goods discussion we've already had. In other words, Christian political thinkers usually don't object to that, but it's not a problem. It's just that that's what government can provide, so it's what it should. But the addendum there in some right-wing philosophy is that it actually makes people feel bad, that they feel like they just can't cut it, or like they're lesser, and the government is just cementing that negative feeling in. And I recall you having an interesting take on that in comparison with other countries and other programs.
Yeah, so there's this kind of self-sealing nature to that particular argument, in which, you know, people feel bad because we tell them to feel bad about certain things, right? I mean, if you're on the right wing and you're saying, you know, people are takers and moochers and parasites and, you know, welfare dependent, you know, like, you have all these very negative things to say about that. And that colors people's perception, right, and makes them feel bad. I don't, you know, in and of itself, I find it hard to believe that people actually, you know, have these issues. And we know, because we have big welfare programs in the United States that people don't feel bad about, like the Social Security. I mean, even the Republicans are big on that, at least in, you know, in their rhetoric. So you get your Social Security check. I've never heard anyone be like, oh man, I feel really bad about getting the Social Security check. Right.
Right.
And then there are other things that we do, and this gets back to the submerged state, that, you know, don't make people feel bad, but then again, they don't really know that they're getting them, like the mortgage interest tax deduction and stuff like that. So I guess my point is to say that a lot of that sort of cultural and ideological, and depends upon what you tell yourself as a society. If you want to tell yourself, hey, you know, we're all in this together, and this is part of our sort of social system of how we distribute income, instead of saying, oh, you're taking from the rich and giving to all these dependent, this and that, I think that's going to color a lot of people's perceptions.
Right.
And you see that, I think, especially with the children. Like, his example of a kid, kids don't know that getting the free lunch is a bad thing. I mean, surely they don't, that's not just something that's inborn in them.
Right.
Well, it's got to be something people are told.
He claimed, and it actually turned out that story was...
Yeah.
It had a checkered past, but in terms of how it was sourced and reported. But his claim was that the paper sack lunch signified love, and that's what kids really want, is parents who love them enough to buy them a lunch. And I mean, that's just... It's a hard thing to parse politically, because I also wish I could sort of universally enforce people to love one another. I can't. However, you can equip parents to buy their kids food.
With a child allowance,
right. I mean, right, there are things that you can do to equip people to take care of themselves. And something like a child allowance would certainly allow the kid to have the paper sack lunch. I can't guarantee that a child allowance would cause a parent to love a child. Now we return to McArdle's point that I actually can't cause people to love one another.
Yeah.
There are certainly philosophies you can advocate that promote love.
Yeah.
I know the
But
major one. I study it.
it's just orthogonal, though,
Right, but
ultimately, to
it's
say
ultimately not something that you can do politically.